based on a little bit of research that I've been doing for another project. So the topic today is men and masculinity in crisis. It sounds pretty heavy, doesn't it? A resource for men in crisis, if you're interested, is an author named Richard Reeves, social scientist. Ezra Klein did a really good lengthy interview with Richard Reeves. Of Boys and Men is the book. Why the Modern Male is Struggling, Why It Matters, and What to Do About It. I think it's in the notes there if you're interested. But boys falling behind academically, 50% more likely to fail in science, math, and reading than girls. Marriage rates down, male friendships in significant decline. Reeves calls it a friendship recession. Makes a lot of male isolation, bad mental health outcomes, all the things. Reeves would say that the loss of traditional male roles over many decades has left a kind of a meaning, purpose, what am I here for, vacuum for many men. That's the downside. The upside is equality for women more. But Reeves is calling for a new positive vision of masculinity compatible with gender equality and with real opportunities for men to meaningfully contribute to society. The manosphere, anyone know what the manosphere is? It's like something happening. You don't know what the manosphere is? Oh my gosh. I feel pretty good about myself. it's just a bunch of podcasts, right? The Joe Rogan Experience and all that. And it's platforming like a return to the 1950s gender roles approach. You probably know more about the manosphere than me, but apparently not. By all reports, this is AI, by the way, big uptick on the manosphere and calls for return to gender roles, vision of masculinity that celebrates male aggression, aggressively anti-woke, a given, platforms a critique of empathy, which is a virtue that manly men should avoid because it makes them weak. You want to guess the two top Christian books with empathy in the title? Toxic Empathy, How Progressives Exploit Christian Compassion, and The Sin of Empathy. I'm sorry to report, we've got to take back Christianity. This is ridiculous. This is not possible. Next time, I think we might talk about empathy as a requirement of biblical holiness in the best book of the Bible, Leviticus. So, masculinity means different things to different people, so I'll situate myself in that. As a late teenager, living in married student housing with Nancy and our firstborn, I had a neighbor, Joseph Arthungal, who's a grad student from Kerala, India, the southernmost state of India. He was part of the Ceylon Pentecostal mission. That's where I get some of my Pentecostal roots. Joseph knocked on our apartment door one time, invited us to his home Bible study. We were brand new Jesus freaks. We were desperate for friends. Joseph and Lily were in their 30s. They had two small kids, and Joseph took me under his wing. He was my first mentor as a new, brand new Christian. He schooled me in how to witness. So I wrote the tracts because I was more culturally tuned in to what was going on, and we passed them out on the U of M buses. Once when we're walking back from the bus to our respective apartments, he takes my hand, and I'm walking with Joseph, hand in hand. And I'd had an anthropology class by that time, and I thought, this is a cultural difference. You should just roll with it. Joseph took Sunday off as a day of prayer. He wore a like wrap around, I don't know if it was called a sari or not, but like a what appeared to be a wrap around dress, traditional garb. The two things I knew that men should never do was hold hands with other men and wear a dress. So he was like showing me a different way. Maybe this kind of gave me the space in my brain to transfer to the University of Michigan School of Nursing, where I was one of three among 250 classmates, three men among 250 classmates. So the first day of class, It's all like big, everybody in the class did a big lecture. I held the door open for my classmates, as I had been trained to do for women, and I waited as 247 of my classmates entered. We actually migrated from class to class in the medical science building in that first semester, and that was just meant going through long hallways with doors, and I would open the door and wait for... After a week, I said, this is not sustainable. You know, if people heard I was in nursing school, they would say, oh, you're going to be a male nurse? I developed a lot of good stock responses to that, like, let me go check. So fast forward to 1980, I'm the father of four by this time. Nancy and I are part of an intense, ecumenical, charismatic Christian community at the epicenter of the worldwide Catholic charismatic movement. Very heady days, cardinals visiting that community, bishops visiting that community to see what's going on, Catholic leaders of that community having personal audiences with the Pope, organizing rallies in Notre Dame that filled the Notre Dame stat. You can imagine with, you know, touchdown Jesus, invisible. Daniel's church, I believe, was influenced. His Baptist church in Monroe was influenced and became charismatic through this community that I was part of. So that same year, one of the founders of the community, Steve Clark, a leading light in the Catholic charismatic movement, released a book titled Man and Woman in Christ, making the case for a return to traditional gender roles. I was at that time asked to write a book, little book for the community publishing house, and so I wrote my first little book, God First. And it's like, I had it figured out, you know, it was like, God first, 6 billion people second, me third, you know? And then after the population reached 8.2 billion, I was like, this is not sustainable. So it's 1980, my long hair and my beads are gone. My John Lennon wire-rim glasses are replaced by dark tortoise shell, and I have a thick mustache. The next year, my wife said, Ken, you can keep the mustache, or you can be satisfied kissing yourself. Mustache went. I'm doing the author photo. I've never had an author photo before, and my pastoral leader, a protege of Steve Clark, the author of that book I mentioned, told me not to smile for the author photograph because men smiling for photographs was a symptom of the feminization of men, which was a bad thing. So if anyone's interested, I have a picture picture right here. I'll leave it somewhere so you can look at it and have a good laugh. What would I tell my younger self posing for a picture like I was sitting on a broomstick and not one laying flat either? I would tell myself, you know, Ken, men were struggling for reasons other than the rise of second wave feminism in the 1960s. Men were traumatized in World War II. Their fathers were traumatized in World War I. My father and his father came back from their wars with undiagnosed, untreated PTSD. In post-war America, the Jewish community, many with literally numbers tattooed on their arms, were traumatized by the Holocaust, and nobody in psychiatry or in the medical community knew anything about trauma until decades later. I would tell myself also to read the Bible more carefully and notice the masculinity norms of the 1950s were not actually all that traditional compared to the masculinity norms you see in the Bible. In Christian theology, of course, Jesus is fully human and fully divine. What we forget about the fully human part of that equation is that to be fully human is to be embedded and shaped by the culture that you're part of. There's no other way of being human except that, and his culture was patriarchal. And yes, he probably had some Jewish, like other Jewish men of his time, probably had some friendships with women. There may be other sages, we don't know, of that period, who had women who were disciples. But actually, the only thing we know about rabbis from that period is from Jesus, the writings of Jesus. So Hillel, famous rabbi, like two little scraps of information. So often Christians will take something that Jesus does that's cool and say it's unique. But we don't actually know that. What's unique about Jesus is we have all this information about him compared to other people of his period. So yes, he was like somewhat progressive for his time. Women were the first witnesses to the resurrection in the Gospels. That doesn't make the Jesus of the Gospels into a modern feminist. I love Jesus and I wish he were a Tigers fan, but Jesus appointed 12 apostles, all men. When pastors say that's why pastors should be men, my daughter, who is present here today, says, I agree, Jewish men, just like the 12 apostles, we'd all be better off. That's a good line. I didn't deliver it nearly as well as I could have. However, as a man of the ancient Near East, Jesus was shaped by a very different masculinity set of conventions than prevailed in the 1950s. Many aspects of his masculinity were actually feminine by modern standards. So how so? Elle actually covered some of this material during Elle's internship. Jesus wept at the tomb of his friend Lazarus. This cannot have been the first time that Jesus wept in public. Yeah. Men all over the world weep in public, just not around here so much. I was trained not to cry, let alone weep in public, not by my parents so much, but by the world I grew up in. Our dads, those World War vets, they sucked it up, man. They were not crying in boot camp. We, their sons, were not going to shame our dads by crying in public or private. I learned the value of crying over many years, living and working with people who felt comfortable crying, which tended to be women, and knowing some old, comfortable in their skin men who learned to cry late in life, like my gaffer, my father-in-law. I mean, he's a C.S. Lewis scholar. He's a devout Episcopalian. He knows hymns backward and forward. He can quote them. He knows John Donne poetry. He knows Gerard Manley Hopkins. I like Gerard Manley Hopkins. I would ask him, hey, Dad, can you quote Wendover for me? And he would quote it, and then like a little spring shower would like kind of clouds would come over his face, and he'd turn red, and when it came to the Christ, whatever, he would like burst into tears. It's just the most awesome, awesome thing. And there are other men like my new father-in-law. So, where was I? Jesus wept. No, crying in boot camp. I learned the value of crying. it really got me. It got me like off my game talking about crying. Like, ooh, I'm doing it in public. Now, I am so advanced that I know when I need a good cry. Like, I don't actually have the cry, but I know that I need a good cry. And so, like, I set an intention, and I say, the next time I even feel a little bit like crying, I'm just gonna let it go. I'm not gonna try to stop it. And then I've developed, like, a bag of tricks, like certain music, like the soundtrack to Castaway does it for me. Max Richter on the Nature of Daylight does it for me. I do a fair amount of crying in the back row there during church, during the worship, and it's like, it's good. A really good sermon, that'll get me like crying. Now when I say crying, I mean like inward crying more than anything, I count it. It's worth it. So, boys don't cry or Jesus wept. Two different masculinities, right? When Jesus was in acute distress, he didn't isolate. This is kind of a typical strategy for the way men are socialized today. He didn't isolate. He reached out for the support from his friends, actually. He asked them to stay here and watch with me. in Mark chapter 14. So, when in doubt, gut it out, versus stay here and watch with me. Two different masculinities. The last Passover is in John's Gospel, chapter 13. The 12 are situated around a table that's in a U shape. So the way that it would be done would be like there would be a table here and then two tables coming here. And then the people serving could come into the middle of the U to serve the people. And then there would be like couch benches low to the ground that would be on the outer periphery of the U. And then the dining participants would be kind of lounging on their left side, propped up by their left elbow so they could eat with their right hand, with their legs kind of away from the table. And that's the setting for John 13:23. One of his disciples, the one whom Jesus loved, was reclining on his bosom. Was reclining on his bosom. Didn't just tap him on the shoulder, was reclining on his bosom. So the modern equivalent, sorority sisters snuggling on the couch watching a rom-com and eating takeout. Like, this is not typical behavior for men in our culture. You probably don't remember the Bud Light commercials. You guys are living in an entertainment desert, you know? But the Bud Light commercials are the greatest. There's two guys sitting on a dock. One guy cracks open a Bud Light. The other guy is angling for something other than a fish, says, "I love you, man." And the first guy says, "I love you too, but you're not getting my Bud Light." So, two guys fishing on a dock, or the one Jesus loved reclining on his bosom. Two different masculinities. Anthropologists would call a lot of these traits an aspect of homosociality. So a same-sex relationship, not inherently sexual, and marked by a kind of intimacy. That was Joseph holding my hand as we walked from, passing out tracts back to our apartments. David, of course, before he was king, made a private covenant with Jonathan. El did some good work on this. Jonathan was the son of Saul, who was the king. The soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself, 1 Samuel 18. When Jonathan was slain, David lamented, "Jonathan lies slain upon your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. Greatly beloved were you to me. Your love was more wonderful than the love of women." 2 Samuel, verse 26. The text says, of course, during that time, David was weeping over Jonathan. So yes, these, bonds of male affection were also used to exclude women from power in different ways, like the business bros, playing golf together and, cutting deals on the golf course. But my point is, our ancient book attests to a form of masculinity that might be ridiculed today among those who are claiming to speak for men. What can we learn from this? Well, we can reflect on the masculinity norms that we absorbed before we were doing our critical thinking, which, it kind of sets a default setting in a person, no matter how much like your thinking changes or your values changes or how you identify later in life changes. It's like we just absorb those norms. We might like just think about, what are the norms that I absorbed when I was a kid? What was like modeled to me around me? Does it have to be that way? Do I have to be that way? Are there other models? I grew up in the era of probably the most rigid gender roles in it was extremely rigid in the 1950s. The men were coming back from the war. There was intense pressure on women who had entered the workforce en masse to give the boys their jobs back. There were like advertising campaigns about the boys are coming back, they need their jobs. The ad agencies figured out that they could brand the color blue as boy color and then brand the color pink as girl color. That hasn't been around for very long. That's all post-war. And that way they could sell more toys and they could sell more clothes. My best friend until the age of 4 was a girl across the street. By age 5, I realized that is not cool, dude. That's not good. So one of the blessings of being in a setting like ours is seeing other ways of being in the image of God. And that is a blessing for us. Like, wherever we're situated, like, we see, like, a nice diversity of understandings of how you can be a human being in the image of God. Like, women can lead and men can be in support roles. Men can lead too, but anatomy isn't a qualification. Men can be nurturing. Jesus referred to himself in the Gospel of Luke as a mother hen. Women can clean up in fantasy football. I don't even know what fantasy football is. it sounds like a lot of work. Everyone doesn't have to have a gender identity. And I did a wedding for two older gay men. Half the guests were older gay men. This was like a new setting for me. It was delightful. This sampling of men who had a very different masculinity culture than I was used to. It's an honor to know someone who suffered growing up from gender dysphoria and had to struggle against odds to forge a different path to express the image of God. Or what a blessing to know a guy like Pete Miller on our board, retired U of M boxing coach, avid hunter, guy who can tear down a wall and move it to another place on a Saturday morning, who would lay down his life to defend anyone in this room who was getting harassed, Pete Miller. Isn't Latin for the image of God, imago Dei, imago Dei, spelled D-E-I? These three letters need not trigger those who believe that humans are in the imago Dei. I stole that line from Ralph Warnock, senior pastor at Ebenezer Baptist in Atlanta. It was fun to pass it on. So in August, I know our nerds are going to need a little red meat, a little nerd red meat, so I'm just coming attractions because I'm speaking again in Emily's absence in August. And I want to feature Jacob Neusner, the most prolific Jewish biblical scholar of the modern era, who wrote Androgynous Judaism. He's not a queer theorist. He's a leading light in the conservative branch of Judaism. Beth Israel in Town is the conservative synagogue. Temple Beth Emmet is the Reform synagogue. The conservative movement is affirming. But his thesis, Neusner, is that of course ancient Judaism and its writings were patriarchal, but with a twist, because the goal of Judaism, he claims, is to feminize men. The goal of Judaism is to feminize men, according to Jacob Neusner, meaning Judaism urges men to adopt virtues that in Scripture, in Israel's sacred writings, are modeled by the relatively few women featured in the narrative portions of the Bible. So, that's kind of interesting, isn't it? Some years ago, Paul Sonda and I were talking about struggles men have. I think we were probably reading that book that I mentioned, and started a men's group, still going strong today under the leadership of Barney Judge. Is Barney, I see Linda here. He's teaching Sunday school, is Barney. It meets, if I understand it, I'm not participating, I might go back. Meets once a month on Saturday at 9:30 for one hour, no more. And then it meets a second time a month on Monday at 7:30 in the evening. That's super tricky. Two times a month on different days. Mike Keeney zooms in from New Mexico. Mike Lamone goes when he's available. Mike Morton You don't have to be named Mike to be part of the group. Paul Sanders, part of the group. Steve Graves, part of the group. Pete Miller, Jason Corman's a newcomer to the group. It's a good group. It's got a good ethos. It's a place to give and receive support as guys share challenges, good things where it's possible. It's not required to acknowledge feelings beyond I'm stressed. It's not a sensitivity training group, but we're sensitive guys in our own way. If you are allergic to men's groups from your past experience, it's not an accountability group. I'm not explaining it good. You just have to go to try it out sometime. I think I finished the sermon about 5 minutes ago. So let's take a little time to transition for our prayers and for communion. Let's set aside this topic for our meditation. It's Michigan or Washington. Oh, you're there. Hello, Zoomies. Washington, Ohio. Manistee, Michigan. That's pretty nice. Indiana. The sun is out of its hibernation. It's beautiful. I suggest we just take a moment to settle in our place, take a few deep breaths, and then just call to mind something beautiful in the outdoor cathedral, and let's just spend a minute of quiet, people make noise, etc. For me, that would be like a patch of sunlight illuminating three different shades of green along my street when I take a walk at 9 p.m. and it's kind of cooling, so you'll have yours. Dear God, we are thankful to be alive. We are thankful to be alive in this world, the work of your hands. We are glad to be the work of your hands. And we are glad to be animated by your Spirit. Give life. Amen.